Chapter 8. There was a sitting room off of the guest bedroom where the generals held their meetings, and in that room Mr. Hosokawa and General Benjamin played chess for hours at a time. It seemed to be the only thing that took Benjamin's mind off the pain of the shingles. Since they had crept into his eye, they had become infected, and the infection had led to conjunctivitis, and now the eye was fiercely red and rimmed with pustules. The more completely he concentrated on chess, the more he was able to push the pain aside. He never forgot it, but during the game he did not live exactly in the center of it. For a long time the guests were only allowed in limited areas of the house, but now that things were loosening up, the access to other areas was sporadic. Mr. Hosokawa had not even known the room had existed until he was invited back to play. It was a small room, a gaming table and two chairs by the window, a small sofa, a secretary with a writing desk and a glass front filled with leather-bound books. There were yellow draperies on the window, a blue-flowered rug on the floor, a framed picture of a clipper ship. It was not an exceptional room in any way, but it was small, and a small room, after 3 months spent in the vast cavern of the living room, gave Mr. Hosokawa an enormous sense of relief. That comforting tightness a child experiences when bundled into sweaters and a coat. He hadn't thought about it until the third time they played, that in Japan a person was never in such a large room, unless it was a hotel banquet hall or the opera house. He liked the fact that in this room, were he to stand on a chair, he could touch the tips of his fingers to the ceiling. He was especially grateful for anything that made the world feel close and familiar. Everything that Mr. Hosokawa had ever known or suspected about the way life worked had been proven to him to be incorrect these past months. Where before there had been endless hours of work, negotiations and compromises, there were now chess games with a terrorist for whom he felt an unaccountable fondness. Where there had been a respectable family that functioned in the highest order, there were now people he loved and could not speak to. Where there had been a few minutes of opera on a stereo at bedtime, there were now hours of music every day. The living warmth of voice in all its perfection and fallibility. A woman in possession of that voice who sat beside him laughing, holding his hand. The rest of the world believed that Mr. Hosokawa suffered, and he would never be able to explain to them how that was not the case. The rest of the world, he could never push it completely from his mind. His understanding that he would eventually lose every sweetness that had come to him only made him hold those very things closer to his chest. General Benjamin was a good chess player, but he was no better than Mr. Hosokawa. Neither of them was the type to play with a speed clock, and they took every move as if time had yet to be invented. Because they were both equally talented and equally slow, neither man ever became impatient with the other. Once Mr. Hosokawa had gone to the small sofa and closed his eyes while he waited for his turn, and when he woke up, General Benjamin was still moving his rook forward and then back across the same three squares, careful to never take his fingers off the horse's head. They had different strategies. General Benjamin tried to control the center of the board. Mr. Hosokawa played defensively, a pawn here later the knight. One would win and then the other, and neither one made any comment about it. The game, frankly, was more peaceful without language. Cunning moves need not be congratulated. A danger overlooked was not bemoaned. They would tap a queen, then king, once for check, twice for checkmate, as neither could remember the words Gen had written down for them. Even the endings of games came as quiet affairs, a brief nod of acknowledgement and then the business of setting it all up again, so that when the next day came they would be ready to start over. Neither man would have dreamed of leaving the room with the pieces scattered across the table on the wrong sides of the board. Even though it was an enormous house by any standard, there was no privacy for people living in the vice presidential home, not for anyone except Carmen and Gen, who met in the china closet after 2 a.m. in order to keep their lessons a secret. Opera and cooking and games of chess were there for public consumption. The guest room was on the same side of the house as the study where the television nattered on hour after hour, so if one of the young terrorists was looking for entertainment, he would probably let the chess go. The hostages, when they were allowed down the hallway based on the caprice of whoever happened to be holding the gun at the door, were more likely to stay for 10 or 15 minutes of game. But in that time, they were lucky if they saw a single move. They were used to soccer. They tried to consider chess a kind of sport. Certainly it was a game, but they wanted to see something happen. The room had the same effect on the spectators as long liturgical services, algebra lectures, halcyon. The two observers who managed to stay and never fall asleep were Ishmael and Roxanne. Roxanne came to watch the performance of Mr. Hosokawa, who, after all, spent so much of his time watching her, and Ishmael stayed because eventually he wanted to play chess with General Benjamin and Mr. Hosokawa, only he wasn't sure if such a thing was actually allowed. All of the younger terrorists tried to know their limits and not ask for more than they could have. Like all children, they may have pushed on them from time to time, but they were respectful of the generals, and they knew not to ask for too much. They might stay too long watching television, but they never missed their post on guard. They did not tell Messner to bring in gallons of ice cream. Only the generals could do that, and so far they had done it only twice. They did not fight among themselves, though the temptation to do so was overwhelming at times. The generals punished fighting severely, and General Hector took it upon himself to beat the boys longer and harder than they could ever beat one another, to teach them that they had to work together. If there was a terrible need, an argument that could only be settled one way, they met in the basement, took off their shirts, and were careful never to hit each other in the face. Some things were against the rules, rules that were memorized and repeated in drills. Some rules, speaking respectfully to a superior officer, stood firm. Other rules, never speaking to a hostage unless it was to correct him, weakened and fell away. What the generals would and would not allow was not always clear. Silently, Ishmael memorized the chessboard. He didn't know the names of the pieces because no one in the room ever spoke. He practiced in his head the most appropriate way of broaching the subject. He considered asking Gen to ask for him. Gen had a way of making things seem especially important. Or he could ask Gen to ask Messner, who was the man who handled the negotiations. But Gen seemed very busy these days, and Messner, frankly, didn't seem to be doing such a great job, considering that they were all still there. He wished most of all he could ask the vice president, the man whom he held in the greatest esteem and thought of as his friend. But the generals made a special point of ridiculing Ruben, and anything he asked for would certainly be denied. So if Ishmael wanted something, the only logical person to turn to was himself. And after waiting a few more days, he found the courage to make the question. One day was just the same as the next, and so he reasoned there would never be exactly a right time or a wrong time to ask. General Benjamin had just completed his move, and Mr. Hosokawa was only in the earliest stages of considering his next position. Roxanne sat forward on the little sofa, her elbows on her knees, her hands making a comfortable support beneath her chin. She watched the board like something that might try and run away. Ishmael wished he could speak to her. He wondered if she was learning how to play as well. "Sir?" Ishmael began, a sharp chip of ice lodged in his throat. General Benjamin looked up and blinked. He hadn't noticed the boy in the room. Such a small boy. He was an orphan whose uncle had enlisted him to the cause only a few months before their attack, saying all the boys in the family were small, and then came into impressive growth spurts. But Benjamin was beginning to doubt this would ever be true. Ishmael didn't look like a body that was planning on doing anything impressive. Still, he did the best he could to keep up with the others and endure their teasing, and it was helpful to have at least one person who was small, someone who could be hoisted up, pushed through windows.
"What is it?"
"I was wondering, sir, if you would consider..."
He stopped, collected himself, and started again.
"I was wondering if there was time later, if I might play the winner."
It occurred to him then that there was a 50-50 chance that the winner might be Mr. Hosokawa, which might be an inappropriate request.
"Or the loser."
"You play chess?"
General Benjamin asked. Mr. Hosokawa and Roxanne kept their eyes on the board. There was a time, out of politeness, when they would have at least looked at the person who was speaking, even if they couldn't understand a word of what was being said. Now they both knew a little Spanish, and they didn't bother to look up. Mr. Hosokawa was angling for the general's bishop. Roxanne could see what he was thinking.
I think I do. I've been watching. I think I understand it now.
General Benjamin laughed, but it wasn't such an unkind laugh. He tapped Mr. Hosokawa on the arm. Mr. Hosokawa looked up, pushed his glasses up the bridge of his nose, and watched while General Benjamin took one of Ishmael's small hands beneath his own and put it on a pawn. Then he hopped the pawn from place to place on the board. He motioned between the three of them, and that was clear enough. Mr. Hosokawa smiled and clapped the boy on the shoulder.
So you will play the winner, General Benjamin said. Everything is agreed.
Ishmael, feeling a great rush of luck, took up a place at Roxanne's feet and stared at the board the way she did, like it was a living thing. He only had half a game left to learn everything there was to know about chess. Gen rapped lightly on the frame of the door to the study. Messner stood behind him. Everything about Messner's countenance seemed weary except for his hair, which was as bright as daylight. He still wore a white shirt, black pants, and a black tie, and, like the hostages and terrorists alike, his clothes showed signs of wear. He folded his arms and watched the game. He had been on the chess team in college, rode the bus to play against the French, the Italians. He would have liked to play now, but had he stayed in the house for 3 hours, he would have been expected to have something significant to show for it when he came outside. General Benjamin held up his hand without looking. He was beginning to sense that his bishop was in peril. Messner watched the direction of his eyes. He considered telling the general that the bishop wasn't really his problem, but God knows Benjamin never would have listened to him.
"Tell him I've brought today's papers," he said to Gen in French.
He could have said that much in Spanish, but he knew the general would only have glared at him, speaking in the middle of the move. "I'll tell him." Roxanne Koss lifted one hand and waved to Messner, but kept her eyes on the board, as did Ishmael, who felt the creeping bile of fear churning in his esophagus. Maybe he didn't know how to play chess after all.
"Are you planning on springing us anytime soon?" Roxanne asked.
"No one moves," Messner said, trying to be light. "I've never seen such a stalemate."
He felt oddly jealous of Ishmael, sitting right there by her feet. He would only have to slide his hand 2 inches to brush against her ankle. "They could starve us out," Roxanne said, her voice steady and calm as if she didn't want to disrupt the game. "The food isn't so terrible, not as bad as it should be if they were really interested in getting things moving. They can't be so intent on freeing us when they essentially give us everything we want." Messner scratched the back of his head.
"I'm afraid that's your fault. If you thought you were famous before you came in this place, you should read about yourself now. You make Kallus look like a spear carrier. If they tried to starve you out, the government would be overthrown in an afternoon."
Roxanne looked up at him, blinked a pretty stage blink, large and pleased. "So if I get out of here alive, I can double my price?"
"You can triple it."
"My God," Roxanne said, and there were her teeth, the very sight of which broke Messner's heart. "Do you realize you've told him how to overthrow the government and he doesn't even know it? It's all he's ever wanted, and he missed it." General Benjamin had his hand on his bishop. He was rocking it side to side. The words passed over him, around him, like water passing over a stone. Messner watched Ishmael. The boy appeared to be holding his breath until the general decided on his move. More than any other negotiation Messner had ever been involved with, he found that he didn't really care who won this one. But that wasn't it exactly, because the government's always won. It was that he wouldn't mind seeing these people get away. The whole lot of them. He wished they could use the tunnel the military was digging, wished they could crawl back into the air vents and down into that tunnel and go back into whatever leafy quarters they came from. Not that they had been a brilliant lot, but maybe for that very reason, they didn't deserve the punishment that would eventually catch up with them. He was sorry for them, that was all. He had never felt sorry for the captors before. Ishmael sighed as General Benjamin took his hand off his bishop and chose the knight instead. It was a bad move. Even Ishmael could see that. He leaned back against the couch, and when he did, Roxanne draped one arm across his shoulder and put her other hand on the top of his head, touching his hair as absently as she did her own. But Ishmael barely felt it. He kept his eyes on the chess game, which in 6 more moves was over.
"Well, that's enough," General Benjamin said to no one.
As soon as the game was finished, the floodgate opened again and set all the pain in motion. He shook Mr. Hosokawa's hand in the quick and formal way they did after every game. Mr. Hosokawa bowed several times, and Benjamin bowed in return, a weird habit that he had picked up, like someone else's nervous tic. After all the bowing, he stretched and then motioned for Ishmael to take his seat.
"But only if the gentleman wishes to play again. Don't impose yourself on him. Again, ask Mr. Hosokawa if he would prefer to wait and play tomorrow."
But Mr. Hosokawa was glad to play with Ishmael, who was already getting comfortable in General Benjamin's warm chair. He began to set up the board.
"What do you have for me?" the general asked Messner. "More of the same, really."
Messner thumbed through the papers. An imperative letter from the president, an imperative letter from the chief of police.
"They won't give in, I have to tell you. If anything, they seem less inclined now than they did before. The government isn't so uncomfortable with the way things have been going. People are starting to become accustomed to the old thing. They walk down the street and they don't even stop."
He handed over the daily list of demands from the military while Gen translated. Some days they didn't even bother to reword the counter-demands. They just made copies and changed the dates with a pencil.
"Well, they will see we are geniuses at waiting. We can wait them out forever."
General Benjamin gave a half-hearted nod as he looked over the papers. Then he opened the little French secretary and he took out his own set of papers, which Gen had typed up the night before.
"You'll give them this."
Messner took the papers without looking at them. It would all be the same. The things they were asking for had become reckless in the last month. The release of political prisoners from other countries, men they didn't even know, food distribution to the poor, a change in voting laws. General Hector had come up with that one after reading some of the vice president's legal books. Instead of curtailing their demands, getting nothing had only made them want more. As usual, they made threats, promises to start killing hostages, but threat, promise, and demand had become a set of decorative adjectives. They meant no more than the stamps and seals the government affixed to their papers. Mr. Hosokawa let Ishmael go first. The boy opened with his third pawn. General Benjamin sat down to watch the game.
"We should talk about this," Messner said. "There's nothing to talk about." "I think," Messner started.
He was feeling a weight of responsibility. He was starting to think that if he were only a more clever man, he might have talked this thing through by now.
"There are things you must consider."
"Shh," General Benjamin said and held his finger to his lips. He pointed to the board.
"It's starting now."
Messner leaned against the wall, suddenly exhausted. Ishmael removed the tip of his finger from his pawn.
"Let me walk you out," Roxanne said to Messner.
"What?"
General Benjamin said.
"She said she'll take Mr. Messner to the door," Gen said.
General Benjamin did not care to go along. He was interested in seeing if the boy could actually play.
"Tell me what they're going to do," Roxanne said as they walked down the hall.
Gen had come along, and so the three of them spoke in English.
"I have no idea."
"You have some idea," Roxanne said. He looked at her.
Every time he saw her, he was surprised all over again by how small she was. At night, in his memory, she was towering, powerful. But standing beside her, she was small enough to slip beneath a coat if he had been wearing one, small enough to sweep out of the house quietly beneath one arm. He had the perfect trench coat at home in Geneva. It had been his father's, and his father had been a bigger man. Messner wore it anyway, out of a combined sense of love and practicality, and it billowed behind him as he walked.
"I am a farrier. A delivery service. I bring in the papers, take out the papers, make sure there is plenty of butter for the rolls. They don't tell me anything."
Roxanne put her arm through his, not in a flirtatious way, but in the manner of a heroine in a 19th-century English novel going for a walk with a gentleman. Messner could feel the warmth of her hand through his shirt sleeve. He did not want to leave her inside.
Tell me, she whispered. I'm losing track of time. Some days I think this is where I live, where I'm always going to live. If I knew that for sure, then I could feel settled. Do you understand that? If it's going to be a very long time, I want to know.
To see her every day, to stand out on the sidewalk in the mornings with the thronging crowd to hear her sing, wasn't that a remarkable thing?
I imagine, Messner said quietly, that it's going to be a very long time.
As they walked, Gen trailed behind them like a well-trained butler, both discreet and present if he was needed in any way. He listened. Messner said it, a very long time. He thought of Carmen. Of all the languages there were for a smart girl to learn, they might need a very long time. When Rubén saw the three of them coming, he moved briskly up the hallway before any of the soldiers could cut him off.
Messner, he said, it's a miracle. I wait for you, and then you manage to slip right by me. How is our government? Have they replaced me yet?
Impossible, Messner said.
Roxanne stepped away, stepped back toward Gen, and Messner felt the air cooling all around him.
We need soap, the vice president said. All sorts of soap. Bar soap, dishwashing soap, laundry soap.
Messner was distracted. His conversation with Roxanne should have lasted longer. They didn't need Gen. Messner often dreamed in English. There was never a moment to be alone.
I'll see what I can do.
Rubén's face darkened.
I'm not asking for anything so complicated. I'll bring it tomorrow, he said, his voice growing soft.
Why all this sudden tenderness? Messner wanted to go back to Switzerland, where the postman, who never recognized him when they passed in the hallway, always put mail into the correct slot. He wanted to be unneeded, unknown.
Your face has finally healed up,
the vice president, sensing the ridiculousness of his anger, the burden on his friend, touched his own cheek.
I never thought it would happen. It's one hell of a scar, don't you think? It will make you a hero of the people, Messner said.
I'll say I got it from you,
Rubén said, looking up into Messner's pale eyes. A knife fight in a bar. Messner went to the door and held out his arms, and Beatriz and Jesus, the two guards on the door, worked him over until he felt embarrassed by the persistence of Beatriz's hands. It was one thing, the way they shook him down when he came in. He could not understand why the whole process needed to be repeated upon his exit. What was he smuggling out?
They think you might be taking the soap, the vice president said, as if he was reading his friend's mind. They wonder where it has all gone to when they haven't been using any of it themselves. Get back to the sofa, Jesus said, and laid two directional fingers on the top of his gun.
The vice president was ready for a nap anyway and went his way without further instruction. Messner went out the door without saying goodbye. All the time Roxanne was thinking. She thought about Messner and how it seemed to her he would have rather been a hostage himself instead of bearing the burden of being the only person in the world who was free to come and go. She thought about Schubertlieder, Puccini's arias, the performances she'd missed in Argentina and the performances she had missed by now in New York that had taken forever to negotiate and had been so important to her, though she had not admitted it at the time. She thought of what she would sing tomorrow in the living room. More Rossini? Mostly, she thought about Mr. Hosokawa, and how she had grown so dependent on him. If he hadn't been there, she thought she would have completely lost her mind in the first week. But of course, if he hadn't been there, she never would have come to this country. She never would have even been asked. Her life would have gone on like a train on schedule. Argentina, New York. A visit to Chicago, then back to Italy. Now she was completely stopped. She thought of Katsumi Hosokawa sitting by the window listening while she sang, and she wondered how it was possible to love someone you couldn't even speak to. She believed now there was a reason why all of this had happened. His birthday and her invitation to be, in a sense, his birthday present. Why they had been stuck here all this time. How else would they have met? How else would there have been any way to get to know someone you couldn't speak to, someone who lived on the other side of the world, unless you were given an enormous amount of empty time to simply sit and wait together?
She would have to take care of Carmen, that was the first thing.
You know Carmen, Roxanne said to Gen. They were on their way back to see how the chess game was progressing, but she stopped him in the middle of the hall when they were far from any door.
Carmen?
I know you know who she is, but you know her a little too, don't you? I've seen the two of you speaking.
Of course.
Gen felt a flush rising up in his chest, and he willed it not to go any farther, as if one could will such a thing. But Roxanne wasn't looking at him. Her eyes seemed slightly out of focus, like she was tired. It was only noon, but she was often tired after she sang in the morning. The guards would let her go upstairs alone to go back to sleep. If Carmen wasn't on watch, sometimes she would find her and take her wrist, and Carmen would follow her. It was so much easier to sleep when she was there. Carmen was probably 20 years younger than she was, but there was something about her, something that settled Roxanne down.
She's a sweet girl. She brings me breakfast in the morning. Sometimes I open the door to my room at night and she's sleeping in the hall, she said. Not all the time.
Not all the time, not when she was with him. Roxanne looked back at him and smiled a little. Poor Gen. You're always in the middle of everything. Anyone who has a secret has to take it through you.
I'm sure there's plenty I miss.
I need you to do me a favor, just like everybody else. I need you to do something. Because if Messner was right, if it was still going to be a very long time that they were held hostage, then she deserved to have this. And if at the end of that long time they were killed anyway, because that was always the talk, that the military would shoot them to pin it on the terrorists or that the terrorists would kill them in a moment of desperation, though she found this harder to believe, then she deserved it all the more. And if the third scenario were true, that they would be released quickly and unharmed, that they all would go back to their regular lives and put this behind them, then she would deserve it most of all, because certainly then she would not see Katsumi Hosokawa again. Find Carmen tonight and tell her to sleep somewhere else. Tell her she shouldn't come up with breakfast in the morning. You'd do that for me?
Gen nodded.
But that wasn't asking for quite enough. That wasn't asking for everything, because she had no way of telling Mr. Hosokawa he should come to her tonight. She wanted to ask him to come to her room, but there was only one way of doing that, to ask Gen to go to him and say it in Japanese. And what did she mean to say exactly? That she meant for him to stay the night? And Gen would have to ask Carmen to find a way to get Mr. Hosokawa upstairs. And what if they were found out? What would happen to Mr. Hosokawa then, and Carmen? It used to be if you met someone and you wanted to see them. Maybe you went out to dinner, had a drink. She leaned back against the wall. Two boys with guns walked by, but they never teased or poked when Roxanne was there. Once they had passed, she took a deep breath and told Gen everything she wanted. He did not tell her this was all insanity. He listened to her as if she wasn't asking for anything unusual at all, nodding while she spoke. Maybe a translator was not unlike a doctor, a lawyer, a priest even. They must have some code of ethics that prevented them from gossiping, and even if she wasn't positive then of his loyalty to her, she knew he would do everything possible to protect Mr. Hosokawa. Ruben Iglesias went into what he still thought of as the guest room, but was now the general's office, in order to empty the waste baskets. He was going from room to room with a large green trash bag, taking not only what had been thrown away in the cans, but what was on the floor as well, pop bottles, banana peels, the bits of the newspaper which had been edited out. Ruben surreptitiously deposited those into his pockets to read late at night with a flashlight. Mr. Hosokawa and Ishmael were playing chess, and he stood in the door for a minute to watch. He was very proud of Ishmael, who was so much brighter than the other boys. Ruben had bought that set to teach the game to his son, Marco, but he still felt the boy was too young to learn. General Benjamin was sitting on the couch, and after a while he looked up at Ruben. The sight of his eye, so badly infected, took Ruben's breath away.
That Ishmael, he's a fast learner, General Benjamin said. Nobody taught him the game, you know. He just picked it up from watching.
The boy's accomplishment had put him in a good mood. It reminded him of when he used to be a schoolteacher.
Come into the hall for a moment, Ruben said to him quietly. I must speak to you about something.
Then speak to me here.
Ruben cast his eyes toward the boy, indicating that this was a private matter between men. Benjamin sighed and pushed himself off the couch.
Everyone has a problem, he said.
Outside the doorway, Ruben put down his bag of trash. He did not like to speak to the generals. His first encounter with them had set a precedent which he followed, but no decent man could pretend not to notice such a thing.
What is it you need? Benjamin said, his voice heavy.
What you need? Ruben said. He reached into his pocket and took out a bottle of pills with his name on them.
Antibiotics. Look, they gave me more than I would ever need. They stopped the infection in my face.
Good for you, General Benjamin said.
And you, there are plenty here, take them. You will be surprised by the difference they make.
You are a doctor?
You don't need to be a doctor to see an infection, I'm telling you.
Benjamin smiled at him.
How do I know you don't mean to poison me, little Vice President?
Yes, yes.
Ruben sighed.
I mean to poison you. I mean for us to die together.
He opened the bottle and shook one of the pills into his mouth, and after making sure to show Benjamin how it sat there on his tongue, he swallowed it. Then he handed the bottle over to the general.
I will not ask you what you mean to do with them, but there, they are yours.
After that, Benjamin returned to the chess game, and Ruben picked up the trash and headed on to the next room in the hall. It was Saturday, but since all the days were essentially the same, the only two people who gave this any thought at all were Father Arguedas, who heard confession on Saturday and planned for his Sunday Mass, and Beatrice, who found the weekends to be an unbearable wasteland because the program she liked, The Story of Maria, was only on Monday through Friday.
It is a healthy thing to wait, General Alfredo told her, because he enjoyed the show himself. It gives you a sense of anticipation.
I don't want to wait,
she said, and suddenly thought that she might cry with frustration, the dull white stretch of the afternoon pushing out endlessly in every direction. She had already cleaned her gun and passed inspection, and she didn't have to stand guard until night. She could have taken a nap, or looked at one of the magazines she had seen and not understood 100 times before, but the thought of it all seemed unbearable. She wanted out of this place. She wanted to walk down the streets in the city like any other girl and have men tap their horns as they drove by her. She wanted to do something.
I'm going to see the priest,
she said to Alfredo. She quickly turned her face away. To cry was strictly forbidden. She thought of it as the worst thing she could do. Father Arguedas adopted a translator-optional policy in regard to confession. If people chose to confess in a language other than Spanish, then he would be happy to sit and listen and assume their sins were filtered through him and washed away by God, exactly as they would have been if he had understood what they were saying. If people would rather be understood in a more traditional way, then they were welcome to bring Gen along, if it worked out with his schedule. Gen was perfect for the job, as he seemed to have a remarkable ability not to listen to the words coming out of his own mouth. But that didn't matter, because today Oscar Mendoza was confessing in the language they both grew up speaking. They sat face to face on 2 dining room chairs pulled over to the corner. People respected the arrangement and avoided the dining room when they saw the priest was sitting down with someone there. At first, Father Arguedas had brought up the idea of trying to rig up some sort of proper confessional in the coat closet, but the generals would not allow it. All of the hostages must be out in the open where they could be clearly seen at all times.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 3 weeks since my last confession. At home I go every week, I promise you that, but there isn't a great deal of opportunity to sin in our present circumstances, Oscar Mendoza said. No drinking, no gambling, only 3 women. Even to try and sin with yourself is nearly impossible. There is so little privacy. There are rewards to the way we live.
Mendoza nodded, though he could hardly see it as such.
I am having dreams, though. Can certain types of dreams constitute a sin, Father?
The priest shrugged. He enjoyed confession, the chance to talk to people, possibly to relieve them of their burden.
He could count on one hand the number of times he had been allowed to hear confession before the kidnapping, but since then there had been instances when there had been several people waiting to speak to him. Perhaps he would have chosen slightly more sin, if only because it would have kept the people with him longer. Dreams are a matter of the subconscious. That's unclear territory. Still, I think it would be best if you told me, then maybe I can help you. Beatrice leaned her head into the doorway, her heavy braids swung down against the light.
Are you finished yet?
Not yet, the priest said.
Soon?
Go and play for a while. I can see you next. Play? Did he think she was a child? She looked at Gen's big watch on her wrist. It was 17 minutes after 1 o'clock. She understood the watch perfectly now, though it dogged her a little. She couldn't go for more than 3 minutes without checking the time, no matter how hard she tried to ignore it. Beatrice lay down on a small red oriental carpet just outside the door, where Father couldn't see her, but she could comfortably hear confession. She slipped the end of her braid into her mouth. Oscar Mendoza had a voice as big as his shoulders, and it carried easily, even when he whispered.
It is more or less the same dream every night.
Oscar Mendoza stopped, not entirely sure he wanted to say anything too horrible to such a young priest.
Dreams of terrible violence.
Against our captors? The priest said quietly. Out in the hall, Beatrice lifted up her head.
Oh, no, nothing like that. I wish they would leave us alone, but I don't wish them any particular violence, at least not usually. No, the dreams that I have are about my daughters. I come home from this place. I escape or am freed. It's different in different dreams. And when I get to my house, it is full of boys. It's like some sort of boys' academy. Boys of every size, light-skinned, dark-skinned, some fat, some lanky, they're everywhere. They're eating out of my refrigerator and smoking cigarettes on my porch. They're in my bathroom, using my razor. When I pass them, they glance up, give me a dull look, like they couldn't really be bothered, and then they go back to whatever it was they were doing. But that's not the terrible part. These boys, what they are mostly doing, they are having knowledge of my daughters. They are lined up outside their bedrooms, even the rooms of my two little girls. It is a terrible thing, Father. From some of the doors I hear laughing, and from others I hear sobbing, and I start to kill the boys one by one. I go down the hall and I break them apart like matches. They don't even step away from me. Each one looks so surprised just before I reach up to snap his neck in my hands.
Oscar's hands were shaking, and he knotted them together and pressed them between his knees. Beatrice tried to look discreetly around the corner to see if the big man was crying. She thought she could detect a trembling in his voice. Were these the sorts of things other people dreamed about? Was this what they confessed? She checked the watch, 1:20.
Ah, Oscar, Oscar.
Father Arguedas patted his shoulder.
It is just the pressure. It's not a sin. We pray that our minds don't turn toward terrible things, but sometimes they do, and it is beyond our control.
It feels very real at the time,
Oscar said, and then he added reluctantly,
I'm not so unhappy in the dreams. I feel a rage, but I'm glad to be killing them.
This piece of information was perhaps more troubling.
The thing to do, then, is to learn. Pray for God's strength, for his justice. Then, when the time comes for you to go back to your home, there will be peace in your heart.
I suppose.
Oscar nodded slowly, feeling unconvinced. He realized now that what he had wanted the priest to do was not to absolve him, but to reassure him that it was impossible, the things he dreamed about. That his daughters were safe and unmolested in their home. Father Arguedas looked at him very closely. He leaned in towards him, his voice full of portent.
Pray to the Virgin. 3 rosaries. Do you understand me?
He took his own rosary out of his pocket and pressed it into Oscar's big hands.
3 rosaries,
Oscar said. And sure enough, there was a loosening of pressure in his chest as he began to work the beads through his fingers. He left the room thanking Father. At least if he could pray, he would be doing something. The priest took a few minutes to pray for the sins of Oscar Mendoza, and when he was finished, he cleared his throat and called out,
Beatrice, was that fun for you?
She waited, dried her braid on her sleeve. Then she simply rolled over onto her stomach so that now she was facing into the room.
I don't know what you mean.
You shouldn't be listening.
You are a prisoner,
she said, but without much conviction. She would never raise her gun to a priest, and so she pointed her finger at him instead.
I have every right to hear what you are saying.
Father Arguedas leaned back in his chair. To make sure we weren't in here plotting to kill you in your sleep?
Exactly.
Come in now and make your confession. You have something to confess already. That will make it easier. Father Arguedas was bluffing. None of the terrorists made confession, although many of them came to Mass and he let them take communion just the same. He thought it was probably a rule of the general's, no confession. But Beatrice had never made confession before. In her village, the priest came through irregularly, only when his schedule permitted it. The priest was a very busy man who served a large region in the mountains. Sometimes months would pass between visits, and then, when he came, his time was crowded up with not only the Mass itself, but baptisms and marriages, funerals, land disputes, communion. Confession was saved for murderers and the terminally ill, not idle girls who had done nothing worse than pinch their sisters or disobey their mothers. It was something for the very grown-up and for the very wicked, and if she were to tell the truth, Beatrice considered herself to be neither of those things. Father Arguedas held out his hand, and he spoke to her softly. Really, he was the only one who ever spoke to her in that tone.
Come here, he said. I'll make this very easy for you.
It was so simple to go to him, to sit down in the chair. He told her to bow her head, and then he put a hand on either side of the straight part of her hair and began to pray for her. She didn't listen to the prayer. She only heard words here and there, beautiful words, Father and blessed and forgiveness. It was just such a pleasant sensation, the weight of his hands on her head. When he finally took his hands away, after what seemed to be a very long time, she felt delightfully weightless, free. She lifted up her face and smiled at him.
Now you call your sins to mind, he said. Usually, you do that before you come. You pray to God to give you the courage to remember your sins and the courage to release them. And when you come to the confessional, you say, Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. This is my first confession.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. This is my first confession.
Father Arguedas waited for a while, but Beatrice only continued to smile at him.
Now you tell me your sins.
What are they?
Well, he said, to start with, you listened in on Mr. Mendoza's confession when you knew it was the wrong thing to do. She shook her head.
That wasn't a sin. I told you I was doing my job.
Father Arguedas put his hands on her shoulders this time, and it had the same wonderfully calming effect on her.
While you are in confession, you must tell the absolute truth. You are telling the truth to God through me, and I will never tell another living soul. What this is between you and me and God. It is a sacred rite, and you must never, never lie when you make your confession. Do you understand that?
I do,
Beatrice whispered. He had the nicest face of anyone here, nicer even than Gans, who she had liked a little bit before. All the other hostages were too old, and the boys in her troop were too young, and the generals were the generals. Pray, the priest said. Try very hard to understand this. Because she liked him, she tried to make herself think about it. With the feel of his hands on her shoulders, she closed her eyes and she prayed. And suddenly it seemed very clear to her. Yes, she knew she was not supposed to listen. She knew it like something she could see behind her closed eyes, and it made her happy.
I confess having listened.
All she had to do was say it, and there it went, floating away from her. It wasn't her sin anymore.
And something else?
Something else, she thought again. She stared hard into the darkness of her closed eyes, the place where she knew the sins stacked up like kindling, dry and ready for a fire. There was something else, lots of something else. She began to see them all. But it was too much, and she didn't know what to call it, how to form so many sins into words.
I shouldn't have pointed the gun, she said finally.
Because there was no way to make sense of all of it. She felt like if she stayed forever, she would never be able to confess them all. Not that she meant to stop doing any of those things. She couldn't stop. It wouldn't be allowed, and she didn't even want to. She could see her sins now,
and knew that she would make more and more of them.
God forgives you, the priest said.
Beatrice opened her eyes and blinked at the priest.
So it will go away?
You'll have to pray, you'll have to be sorry.
I can do that.
Maybe that was the answer. A sort of cycle of sinning and sorriness. She could come every Saturday, maybe more often than that, and he would keep having God forgive her, and then she would be free to go to heaven.
I want you to say some prayers now.
I don't know all the words.
Father Arguedas nodded his head.
We can say them together. I can teach them to you.
But Beatrice, I need you to be kind, to be helpful. That is part of your contrition. I want you to try it just for today. Carmen was in the living room, but so was General Hector and a half dozen of the bigger boys. Four of them played cards and the rest of them watched. They had stuck their knives into the table they played on, something that drove the vice president to the brink of insanity. The table was from the early 1800s, hand-carved by Spanish artisans who never envisioned that knives would bristle from the wood's smooth top like so many porcupine quills. Gen walked past them slowly. He could not even attempt to catch Carmen's eye. All he could do was hope that she saw him and would think to follow. Gen stopped and spoke to Simon Thibault, who was stretched across a nearby sofa reading 100 Years of Solitude in Spanish.
This will take me forever, Thibault said to Gen in French. Maybe 100 years. At least I know I have the time.
Who knew that being kidnapped was so much like attending university? Gen said. Thibault laughed and turned a page. Had she heard them talking? Did she see him walking away? He went on to the kitchen, which was mercifully empty, slipped inside the china closet, and waited. Whenever he had come to the china closet, Carmen was already there waiting for him. He had never been in there alone, and the sight of all those plates stacked up above his head filled his heart with love for Carmen. Plates on which two people could eat a year's worth of dinners and never have to wash a dish. There was never a minute alone. A minute when someone wasn't asking him to say something. Always his head was cluttered with other people's overly expressed sentiments. And now it was quiet, and he could imagine Carmen sitting next to him, her long, slender legs folded up in front of her while she conjugated verbs. She had asked him for favors, and now he would ask her for her help. Together they would help Mr. Hosokawa and Miss Koss. Normally, he would say that the private life of one's employer was in no manner his business. But no one pretended any more that this was a normal life. He could not think of Mrs. Hosokawa or Nansei or Japan. Those things had receded so far behind them that it was almost impossible to believe they had ever existed. What he believed in was this china closet, saucers and soup bowls, towering stacks of bread and butter plates. He believed in this night. It struck him that he had looked for Carmen first, that he had not gone back to speak to Mr. Hosokawa, who was most likely still playing chess with Ishmael. He could not be two places at once. And finally he felt himself settling, felt the kitchen floor hard and cold beneath his buttocks, felt the slightest ache in his back. He was here, only here, in this country he did not know, waiting on the girl he taught and loved, waiting to help Mr. Hosokawa, whom he loved as well. There was Gen, who had gone from nothing to loving two people. He didn't know how much time was passing without his watch. He couldn't even guess anymore. 5 minutes felt so much like an hour.
L'amour est un oiseau rebelle que nul ne peut apprivoiser, et c'est bien en vain qu'on l'appelle s'il lui convient de refuser.
He only said the words to himself, humming lightly. He wished that he could sing them, but Gen couldn't sing. And then Carmen came, flushed, as if she had been running, when in fact she had walked to the kitchen as slowly as such a walk was possible to make. She closed the door behind her and sank down on the floor.
I thought this was what you meant,
she whispered, pressing in close beside him as if it were cold.
I thought you would be waiting for me.
Gen took her hands, which were so small. How did he ever think she was only a beautiful boy? I need to ask you something. Love is a rebellious bird that no one can tame, he thought again, and he kissed her. She kissed him for the kiss, touched his hair, whose gloss and weight she found to be an endless source of fascination.
I didn't want to get up right away. I thought I should wait a while before I followed you.
He kissed her. There was such an incredible logic to kissing, such a metal-to-magnet pull between two people, that it was a wonder that they found the strength to prevent themselves from succumbing every second. Rightfully, the world should be a whirlpool of kissing into which we sank and never found the strength to rise up again.
Roxanne Koss came to speak to me today. She said she wants you to sleep somewhere else tonight, to not bring her breakfast in the morning.
Carmen pushed away from him, keeping one hand on his chest. Roxanne Koss didn't want her to bring breakfast?
Did I do something wrong?
Oh, no, Gan said. She thinks very highly of you. She told me so. He tucked her into the crook of his arm, and she breathed into his shoulder. This was what it felt like to be a man with a woman. This was the thing Gen had missed in all the translation of language.
You were right. What you thought about her feelings for Mr. Hosokawa. She wants to be with him tonight.
Carmen raised her head.
How will he get upstairs?
Roxanne wants you to help him.
Gen lived one life, and in that life he was always a prisoner, and his friends were the other prisoners, and even though he loved Carmen and got along politely with some of the terrorists, he never got confused and thought he wanted to join LFDMS. But for Carmen, it was different. She had clearly two lives. She did her push-ups in the morning and stood for inspection. She carried her rifle on guard. She kept a boning knife in her boot, and she knew how to use it. She obeyed orders. She was, as it had been explained to her, part of the force that would bring about change. But she was also the girl who went to the china closet at night, who was learning to read in Spanish, and could already say several things in English. Good morning. I am very well, thank you. Where is the restaurant? Some mornings Roxanne Koss let her climb into the impossibly soft sheets on her big bed, let her close her eyes for a few minutes and pretend she belonged there. She would pretend she was one of the prisoners, that she lived in a world with so many privileges that there was nothing to fight for. But no matter how the two sides got along, they were always two sides. And when she went from one to the other, it was a matter of crossing over something. Either she told Gen she couldn't get Mr. Hosokawa upstairs, in which case she disappointed Gen and Mr. Hosokawa and Miss Koss, who had all been so kind to her, or she told him she could, in which case she broke every oath she had sworn to her party and put herself at risk of a punishment she would not imagine. If Gen had understood any of this, he never would have asked her. For him, it was merely about helping out, being a friend. It was as if he only wanted to borrow a book. Carmen closed her eyes and pretended to be tired. She prayed to St. Rose of Lima.
St. Rose, give me guidance. St. Rose, give me clarity.
She pressed her eyes closed and pleaded for the intercession of the only saint she knew personally. But a saint is very little help when it comes to smuggling a married man into an opera singer's bedroom. On this matter, Carmen was on her own.
Sure,
Carmen whispered, her eyes still closed, her ear pressed to the steady thump of Gen's heart. Gen's hand came up and smoothed her hair over and over again, the way her mother had done when Carmen was a child and had a fever. In the vice presidential mansion, none of the guests, not even Ruben Iglesias himself, knew the house as well as the members of LFDMS. Part of their daily work was the memorization of windows and which ones were wide enough to jump through. They calculated the falls, estimated the damage in terms of their own bones. They each knew the length of the hallways, rooms from which one could make a clear shot to the outside, the fastest exits to the roof, to the garden. So naturally, Carmen knew there was a back stairwell in the hallway off the kitchen that led to the servants' quarters, and that in the very room that Esmeralda had once slept in, there was a door that went to the nursery, and the nursery had a door onto the main hallway of the second floor, and that hallway led to the bedroom, where Roxanne Koss slept. Of course, other people slept on the second floor as well. Generals Benjamin and Hector had rooms on the second floor. General Alfredo, the worst sleeper, found a little rest in the guest suite on the first floor. Many of the boys slept on the second floor, and not always in the same place, which is why Carmen chose to sleep in the hallway outside of Roxanne Koss's room, just in case one of those boys woke up in the middle of the night, restless. Carmen herself had used this route to the china closet every night, her stocking feet silent on the polished wood floor. She knew the location of every creaky board, every potentially light sleeper. She knew how to flatten herself into the shadows when someone came around the corner headed for the bathroom. She could skate those floors as quiet as a blade drawing over ice. Carmen was trained, an expert at remaining silent. Still, she could sense the depth of Mr. Hosokawa's ability to be quiet. Thank God Roxanne Koss had not fallen in love with one of the Russians. She doubted they could make it up the stairs without stopping for a cigarette and telling at least one loud story that no one could understand. Gen was to bring Mr. Hosokawa to the back hallway at 2 a.m., and she would take him to Roxanne Koss's room. 2 hours later, she would come to the door to lead him back. They would say nothing to each other, but that part was easy enough. Even if in this case they were allies, there was nothing they knew to say. Once the plans were made, Carmen left Gen to watch television with the other soldiers. There she saw a repeat broadcast of the story of Maria. Maria had gone to the city to search for her lover, whom she had sent away. She wandered the crowded streets with her little suitcase in her hand, and on every corner strangers lurked in the shadows, conspiring to ruin her. Everyone in the vice president's study wept. Carmen played checkers when the program was over, and she helped with supply lists and volunteered to cover afternoon watch if anyone was feeling tired. She would be exemplary in her helpfulness and willing participation. She did not want to see Gen or Mr. Hosokawa or Roxanne Koss for fear she would blush and give herself away, for fear that she would become angry at them for asking so much of her. How much does a house know? There could not have been gossip, and yet there was a slight tension in the air, the vaguest electricity that made men lift their heads and look and find nothing. The salted fish and rice that came for dinner did not go down well, and one after the other they put their shares on the table half-eaten and walked away. Kato picked out Cole Porter on the piano, and the evening fell into a low blue light. Maybe it was the fine weather, the irritation of once again not being able to walk outside. A half-dozen men stood near an open window and tried to breathe the night air as darkness settled in, taking away the view of the overgrown garden one twisted flower at a time. From the other side of the wall they could hear the faint race of engines, cars that were possibly blocks away from their street. And for a moment the men at the window remembered that there was a world out there, and then just as quickly they let the thought go. Roxanne Koss had gone to bed early. Like Carmen, she didn't want to be there once she had made her decision. Mr. Hosokawa sat next to Gen on the love seat nearest the piano.
"Tell me again," he said. "She wants to see you tonight."
"That's what she said."
"Carmen will take you to her room."
Mr. Hosokawa looked at his hands. They were old hands, his father's hands. His nails were long.
"It's very awkward that Carmen should know this, that you should know. There was no other way.
What if it is dangerous for the girl?"
"Carmen knows what she's doing,"
Gen said. "Dangerous. She went down the stairs every night to come to the china closet. He wouldn't ask her to do something that wasn't safe." Mr. Hosokawa nodded slowly. He had the distinct sensation that the living room was tilting, that the living room had become a boat in a gently tilting sea. He had stopped thinking of what he wanted most so many years ago, even when he was a child, perhaps. He disciplined himself to only want the things that were possible to have: an enormous industry, a productive family, an understanding of music. And now, a few months after his 53rd birthday, in a country he had never really seen, he felt desire in the deepest part of himself, the kind of wanting that can only come when the thing you want is very close to you. When he was a child, he dreamed of love, not only to witness it, the way he saw love in the opera, but to feel it himself. But that, he decided, was madness. That was wanting too much. Tonight he wished for little things: the chance to take a hot bath, a reasonable suit of clothing, a gift to bring, at the very least some flowers. But then the room tilted slightly in the other direction, and he opened up his hands, and all of that fell away from him and he wanted nothing. He had been asked to come to her room at 2 a.m., and there was nothing more in the world to want. Ever. When the time came to sleep, Mr. Hosokawa lay flat on his back and looked at his watch by the bright light of the moon. He was afraid he would fall asleep, and he knew he would never fall asleep. He marveled at Gen, who took measured, peaceful breaths on the floor beside him. What he didn't know was that Gen woke up every morning at 2 a.m. as regular as a baby waking for food and slipped out of the living room without ever being missed. Mr. Hosokawa watched the night guard circle, Beatrice and Sergio, and lowered his eyelids whenever they came near. They stopped to watch certain members of his group sleep. They whispered to one another and nodded. By 1 o'clock, they had disappeared exactly the way Gen said they would. This was the world of the night, of which he knew nothing. Mr. Hosokawa could feel his pulse pushing in his temples, his wrists, his neck. He pointed his toes. This was the hour. He had been sleeping forever. He had been dead. Now he was suddenly completely alive. At 5 minutes until 2, Gen sat up as if an alarm had gone off. He stood, looked at his employer, and together they crossed the living room, placing their feet down gently between their sleeping friends and acquaintances. There were the Argentinians. There were the Portuguese. The Germans slept near the Italians. The Russians were safe in the dining room. There was Kato, his dear hands folded on his chest, his fingers twitching almost imperceptibly in his sleep, like a dog dreaming of Schubert. There was the priest, rolled over on his side, both hands under one cheek. Scattered among them were a handful of soldiers sprawled on their backs, as if sleep was a car that had hit them dead on. Their necks twisted sideways, their mouths wrenched open, their rifles resting in their open hands like ripe fruit. In a hallway off the kitchen, Carmen was waiting exactly as Gen said she would be, her dark hair tied into a braid, her feet bare. She looked at Gen first, and he touched her shoulder lightly instead of speaking, and everything was understood among the three of them. There was no sense in waiting, as waiting would have only made it worse. Carmen would have liked to have been in the china closet now, her legs across Gen's lap, reading aloud the practice paragraph he had written up for her. But she had made her choice. She had agreed. She said a quick prayer to the saint who ignored her now and crossed herself as quickly, lightly as a hummingbird touching down 4 times. Then she turned and went down the hall, Mr. Hosokawa moving silently behind her. Gen watched them as they turned away, never having realized it would be worse to be left behind. When they got to the staircase, a narrow, twisting affair whose boards were cheap and only good enough to carry servants from one floor to the other, Carmen turned and looked at Mr. Hosokawa. She leaned over and touched his ankle and then touched her own. She moved their feet together, and when she stood up, he nodded to her. It was very dark, and as they took the stairs, it would get darker. Never had her prayers failed her completely. She tried to believe this was only a lesson, a necessary delay, and that if they were to get caught, she would not be alone forever. All Mr. Hosokawa could see now was the outline of her narrow back. He tried to do what she told him, to place his foot exactly in the place her foot had left, but he couldn't help think about how much smaller she was. Captivity had made him thinner, and as he took the stairs he was grateful for every pound he had lost. He held his breath and listened. Truly, they were silent. He had never been so aware of the complete absence of sound. He had not climbed a set of stairs in the months he had been inside this house, and the very act felt brave and daring. How right it was to climb. How happy he was to finally have the chance to risk himself. When they reached the top, Carmen pushed open the door with her fingertips, and a little light fell onto her face, a reassurance that at least part of the trip was behind them now. She turned and smiled at him. She was a beautiful girl. She was his own daughter. They took the slim hallway to the nanny's room, and when she opened that door there was the slightest hint of a whine. Still no noise from the two of them, but a small sound from the door. There was also someone in the bed. It didn't happen often. The girl who watched the children had the least comfortable bed in the whole house, and rarely would anyone fall asleep there, but it did happen. Tonight it happened. Carmen put her hand against Mr. Hosokawa's chest, so they could wait for a minute for the room to forget the sound the door had made. She could feel his heart beating so clearly, it was as if she were holding it in her hand. Carmen took a breath and waited. Then she nodded without looking back and moved one foot forward. Maybe this was hard, but it was not impossible. It was nothing compared to breaking into the mansion through the air vents. There had been other nights when she had found people sleeping in this bed. It was Beatrice. She had lain down in the middle of night watch. Everyone did. Carmen certainly had. It was too long to stay awake. Sergio would be in some other room, slumped over in a hard and guilty sleep. Beatrice did not have a blanket over her, and her boots were on. In her sleep, she cradled her rifle in her arms like a child. Mr. Hosokawa tried to make his feet move forward, but now he was afraid. He closed his eyes and thought of Roxanne Koss. He thought of love and tried to say a prayer to love. And when he opened his eyes, Beatrice sat up in bed and just as quickly raised her gun. Just as quickly, Carmen stepped between them. These two things Mr. Hosokawa was sure of. Beatrice pointed the rifle at him, and Carmen came in front of the gun. She went to Beatrice, who should have been her friend, the only other girl in a troop of so many men, and grabbed her and held her tight, leaving the rifle to point at the ceiling.
"What are you doing?"
Beatrice hissed. Even she knew this was a quiet business.
"Get away from me."
But Carmen held her. She practically fell into her, she was so frightened, and so oddly relieved now that she had been caught.
"Don't tell,"
she whispered in the other girl's ear.
"You're taking him upstairs? You are in so much trouble."
Beatrice struggled and found Carmen stronger than she had imagined. Or maybe it was just that she had been so deeply asleep. Asleep on guard, and maybe Carmen meant to tell.
"Shh,"
Carmen said. She buried her nose in the loose hair where Beatrice's braid had unraveled in her sleep and kept her grip tight. For a second she forgot about Mr. Hosokawa. And it was only the two of them, only this immediate problem. She could feel Beatrice's back was still warm from the bed and the barrel of the gun pressed cold into her cheek, and even though she had not thought to ask for help, she heard the beloved voice of St. Rose of Lima say to her,
"Tell the truth."
"He's in love with the opera singer,"
Carmen said. She didn't care about secrets now. Her only hope was to do what she was told.
"They wanted to be alone together."
"They would kill you for this,"
Beatrice said, though she thought that probably wasn't true.
"Help me,"
Carmen said. She meant to say it only to her saint, but the words slipped from her lips in desperation. Beatrice thought for a moment she heard the voice of the priest. He had forgiven her. He had instructed her towards kindness. She thought of her own sins and the chance to forgive the sins of others, and she raised up what she could of her pinned-down arm and put it lightly on Carmen's back.
"She loves him?"
Beatrice said.
"I'm going to bring him back in 2 hours."
Beatrice shifted herself in Carmen's arms, and this time Carmen let her go. She could barely make out Carmen's face. She could not be entirely sure it was Mr. Hosokawa there in the darkness. He had taught her to tell time. He had always smiled at her. Once when they reached the door to the kitchen at the same time, he bowed to her. Beatrice closed her eyes, searched the darkness for her own pile of sins.
"I won't tell,"
she whispered. And again, for the second time that day, she felt a loosening as some of her burden was lifted from her. Carmen kissed her cheek. She was full of gratitude. She felt for the first time that she was lucky. Then she stepped back into the shadows. Beatrice had meant to extract a promise from her in return, that she wouldn't tell that she had seen her sleeping. But of course she wouldn't tell. She couldn't. Beatrice lay back on the bed, though she hadn't meant to, and in a minute she was asleep. And the whole business was over with, as suddenly as it had all begun. Through the nursery, where a moon-shaped nightlight still glowed faintly from a wall socket illuminating a cast of lonesome dolls, past yet another bathroom with a white porcelain tub that was bigger than some canoes Carmen had ridden in, and out into the main hall where the house became again the house that they knew, wide and gracious and grand. Carmen led Mr. Hosokawa to the third door, and then she stopped. This was where she slept most nights, the little sleeping she did. She'd been holding on to his hand ever since she had led him away from Beatrice, and she was holding it now. It seemed they had come a very long way, but the vice president's children could make it from their mother's bedroom through the nursery, cutting through Esmeralda's room and down the back stairs to the kitchen in well under a minute, even though they had been told to never run in the house. Carmen liked Mr. Hosokawa. She wished she could tell him so. But if she had had the language, she wouldn't have had the courage. Instead, she pressed his hand once and then let it go. Mr. Hosokawa bowed to her, his face pointing down towards his knees, and he held this position for what seemed to Carmen to be too long. Then he stood again and opened the door. There was a high window in the upstairs hallway, and the main staircase was flooded with the bright light of the moon. But Carmen didn't take the front stairs. She navigated her course backwards, through the nursery and past the bed where Beatrice was sleeping deeply. Carmen stopped to untangle the rifle's trigger from her fingers. She leaned the gun against the wall and pulled a coverlet up over her shoulders. She hoped that Beatrice would not decide to tell in the morning, or better yet, that she would wake up thinking it was all a dream. Coming down the kitchen stairs, Carmen felt a different kind of wild heartbeat. She imagined Roxanne Koss on the other side of the door, anxious from all the waiting. She imagined Mr. Hosokawa, silent and dignified, taking her into his arms. The sweetness of that touch. The security inside the embrace. Carmen raised her hand to the thin pricking of sweat on the back of her neck. She was silent, but still the stairs came faster now. 4, 3, 2, 1. Then she was through the hallway, the kitchen. She skidded to a stop just inside the wondrous world of the china closet, where again sat on the floor, an unopened book on his knees. When he looked up, she put her fingers to her lips. So much brightness in her face, her cheeks flushed, her eyes open wide. When she turned away, of course, he would stand and follow her. How much luck is one person entitled to in a night? Does it come in a limited allotment, like milk in a bottle, and when so much has been poured out, then only so much is left? Or was luck a matter of the day, and on the day you're lucky, you are limitlessly lucky? If it was the former, then surely Carmen had used up all her luck getting Mr. Hosokawa safely into Roxanne Koss's bedroom. But if it was the latter, and in her bones she felt this was the truth, then this was her night. If all the saints in heaven were behind her now, then her luck must be good for a few more hours. Carmen took Gen's hand and led him through the kitchen and onto the back porch, where he had never been before. She opened up the door, simply put her hand on the knob and turned it, and together they walked out into the night. Look at this night. The moon, a floodlight, washing over what had once been an orderly garden. The moonlight pouring over the high stucco wall like water. The air smelled of the thick jasmine vines and the evening lilies that had long ago finished their work and closed up for the day. The grass was high, past their ankles, and brushing heavy against their calves, and it made a shushing sound as they walked. So they stopped to look up at the stars, forgetting that they were right in the middle of a city block. There weren't more than half a dozen stars to see. Carmen went outside all the time. Even in the rain, she had gone out every day to walk on guard or simply to stretch her legs. But for Gen, the night seemed miraculous. The air and the sky, the soft crush of grass beneath his heel. He was back in the world. And the world looked on that night to be an incomprehensibly beautiful place. Such a limited view he was given, yet still he would swear to it the world was beautiful. For the rest of Gen's life, he will remember this night in two completely different ways. First, he will imagine what he did not do. In this version, he takes Carmen's hand and leads her out the gate at the end of the front walkway. There are military guards on the other side of the wall, but they too are young and asleep, and together they pass them and simply walk out into the capital city of the host country. Nobody knows to stop them. They are not famous, and nobody cares. They go to an airport and find a flight back to Japan, and they live there together, happily and forever. Then he will imagine exactly what did happen. It did not occur to him to leave, as it does not occur to a dog to leave once he has been trained to stay in the yard. He only feels blessed for the little freedom he is given. Carmen takes his hand, and together they walk to the place where Esmeralda held picnics for the vice president's children, a place where the wall curves back and makes a pocket of grass and slender trees, and there is no clear view of the house. Carmen kisses him, and he kisses her, and from then on he will never be able to separate the smell of her from the smell of night. They are deep in the lush growth of grass, in a part of the yard that is covered in shadows thrown down by the wall, and Gen can see nothing. Later he would remember that his friend, Mr. Hosokawa, was inside that house on the second floor, in bed with the singer. But on that night he does not think of them at all. Carmen has pulled off her jacket even though there's a cool breeze. She unbuttons his shirt while he covers her breasts with his hands. In the dark they are not themselves at all. They are confident. Gen pulls her down and she pulls him down. They defy gravity in their slow tumble to earth. Neither of them wear shoes and their pants slip off, too big for them anyway. And that feeling, that first luxury of skin touching skin. Sometimes Gen will stop his memory there. Her skin, the night, the grass, to be outside and then to be inside Carmen. He doesn't know to want for more because nothing in his life has been as much as this. At the very moment he could have been taking her away, he is pulling her closer. Her hair is tangled around his neck. On that night he thinks that no one has ever had so much, and only later will he know that he should have asked for more. His fingers slip into the soft indentations between her ribs, the delicate gullies carved out by hunger. He feels her teeth, takes her tongue. Carmen, 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 Carmen. In the future he will try to say her name enough, but he never can. Inside, the house slept, the guests and guards, and no one knew the difference. The Japanese man and his beloved soprano upstairs in bed, the translator and Carmen beneath the six stars outside, nobody missed them. Only Simone Thibault was awake, and he woke up from dreaming of Edith, his wife. When he was fully awake and could see where he was and remember that she wasn't there with him, he began to cry. He tried to stop himself, but he could see her so vividly. They had been in bed in the dream. They had been making love, and in that love each had gently said the other's name. When it was over, Edith had sat up in the tangle of blankets and wrapped her blue scarf around his shoulders to keep him warm. Simone Thibault buried his face in that scarf now, but the crying only came harder. Nothing he could think of would stop it, and after a while he didn't even try.